Hello, and welcome back for another episode of the Botch Deeper podcast. Today, we are joined by the multifaceted Alexander McArger. With backgrounds in stage design, history, architecture, and more, McArger approaches historical analysis from a unique perspective. Currently a doctoral student at the University of Vienna, McArger took part in the Botch Deeper Institute's 2023 conference, Habsburg Encounters with Native America. Much of today's conversation relates to his research into how Native Americans were perceived and portrayed by Habsburg society, particularly in theater and festival culture. I'm your host, Luke Morgante, and I hope you enjoy today's episode. So I guess to start, could you give us a little bit of a background on where you grew up, your professional interests thus far, kind of what you're working on?
Yeah, sure. So I'm originally from outside of Boston, Massachusetts, Andover. I always was a kind of, you know, artsy kid, like building little things and painting and drawing and, you know, huge Lego kind of person. And eventually, I was always in high school in the art room after school. But I went to college at RISD, Rhode Island School of Design, for architecture. But their program there was really great because it was... very well-rounded in terms of, like, I took painting classes and drawing classes and, you know, all kinds of creative classes, even with, you know, as architecture is the main point. And it was just such a great creative community there. I also did a minor in art history. So pretty early on, I kind of started off with this almost like two-road kind of thing, looking at history of art and architecture, as well as being a sort of creative practitioner of art and architecture. And then my first big move, or like sort of first big experience abroad after my undergrad, right after the coming out of the recession of 2007, and I was interested in lots of different jobs and internships and things, and unfortunately there was really no options. So I ended up in Switzerland working at an architecture office there, and I started going to the opera in the evenings because I still had a student card, and that kind of got me thinking about stage design. And my first big jump to Vienna and to Austria was with a Fulbright grant in 2015 to study opera as a cross-cultural and cross-disciplinary art form. And also to kind of compare things I'd seen in the US with opera and you know, the kind of creative world in Europe, and especially in Vienna. I was also working with students at the Angewandte, which is the University of Applied Arts. There's a stage design program there. And by the end of the Fulbright, I mean, I kind of knew before I was thinking about it, but by the end of the Fulbright, my time in Vienna, I really wanted to study stage design, and I was accepted at the Yale School of Drama. So I went back to the U.S., constantly going back and forth, back to the U.S. for my master's in stage design. But I also had some grants, like at the Beinecke Library, a research grant. So I was still keeping up this kind of research road alongside a practical creative road. Not to say that research isn't creative, for sure. But, and then after that, I just really wanted to come back to Austria. So I was able to come back. I was a combined grantee on the Fulbright. So it means I had a full Fulbright project, but I was also a USTA. So I was teaching and I was able to stay actually a second year. So I had 2 years at first. But then after my master's, I went back to Vienna. It was a little difficult during the COVID pandemic, but I made it back. And then I sort of tried to hit the ground running as best I could. I had a lot of collaborative projects with the Theater Museum, the Theater Museum in Vienna, which I'm still associated with. And they were actually also one of my Fulbright sort of mentors, one of the curators there. Yeah. And then basically I've been in Vienna ever since. Doing research projects and stage design and theater work.
It's quite a journey. So it seemed pretty clear that after your first few times from Switzerland to Austria, there was something alluring to you about the European, Central European approach to the arts. What were the main differences that you noticed initially between studying arts and art history, architecture, stage design in the US, and then making the journey over there?
Yeah, definitely. On the art historical side and architectural sort of historical side, in Europe, there's just all of the the stuff you study in terms of like Western art history is most of it is there. So I remember, you know, just walking down streets in Vienna when I first arrived and thinking, wow, you know, I studied that building or I had heard about that building and here it is just sort of embedded in the cityscape and the urban fabric and not just on like a slide projected or something. And then in terms of the creative arts and theater, it was just astounding to me and so encouraging that there's just so much governmental support for the arts. I mean, you know, Vienna, a city of, I think, just around 2 million people, and there are, you know, three major opera houses with, you know, multi-million-dollar budgets, multi-million-euro budgets. And then, but just so many small companies, like so many people then employed for the theaters. It just was such a vibrant and well-supported art scene. And I think, you know, I mean, in the US, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of money on Broadway. But unfortunately, there's just a lot of companies that are really giving it their all. But without so much government support, it can be kind of difficult. And what I also really experienced in my Fulbright too was that a lot of design and theatrical production and operatic production in Europe, I think because it has this sort of support underneath, this net, basically, there's a lot more experimentation. You know, because they don't have to worry completely about, you know, selling tickets, it's not the first priority just to make money back through seats. They can do things that, you know, maybe would, I don't know, upset audiences on one level or be a bit more provocative. Whereas in the US, they might have to do something a little bit safer because they really have to, you know, make a lot of their money through ticket sales. So yeah, I was just very encouraged by a lot of the productions that I saw in Europe. And even with all that support, I mean, you can still go to the state opera for, you know, at the time when I was there in 2015, it was like 3 or 4 euros just to get a standing room ticket, which was also a pretty good view. Whereas, you know, in the US, I think in the Met in New York, it's when I was there in 2014, I think it was like $30 just for a standing room ticket. So just the accessibility of the arts in Europe was also really encouraging.
Yeah, it really, I lived in Berlin very briefly. It was cut short, unfortunately, due to COVID, but It really stood out to me that there's, I guess growing up in the US, when I would think about theater and opera, I would think of it as this very formal, like older art form. Mm-hmm. But then being in Berlin, you quickly realize it is very provocative. There is like an edginess that is sought out many times by people that I didn't really expect, but it is exciting.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, especially for some of the classic pieces that are just put on, you know, I mean, I think I read once that, you know, at least somewhere in the world, or maybe at least in Europe, there's like a production of Magic Flute just somewhere every night there's one. And so when you think about it being put on so many times, you know, there's definitely a tendency or desire to do something new with it, to point out its faults, even, you know, just to kind of to push some of the traditional pieces in certain ways. And that's a lot of what my Fulbright grant was about. The title of it was La Boheme Without the Stovepipe. Meaning like, you know, one of the sort of tropes that's often repeated in La Boheme is, you know, one of the opening scene, you have this little like rooftop attic and there's like a little stove with a little stove pipe that kind of comes up and out and over the stage. I mean, when I was researching stage designs throughout the history of the piece, this was, you know, most of the time there. So I was kind of questioning, well, you know, what if you just took out the stove pipe? What if, like, and obviously on a larger, it was sort of a metaphoric, you know, allegory for like a larger idea, but, you know, what if you kind of flip some of these traditional pieces on their heads, which is definitely something I was able to experience in Vienna. And it's definitely happening in the US too. I shouldn't sound like it's, you know, just something that's only in Europe and Austria and Vienna. There are definitely some great houses. I mean, even the Met has been doing some really interesting new pieces in the last few years.
So one of the first few times that you experienced the opera or a major show over there, do you recall one particularly that stood out to you?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, some of the things that hit me the most, or the memories stick out the most, are actually in Switzerland when I first went, because it was some of the first big scale opera pieces that I saw. I mean, growing up, my parents, you know, got tickets once in a while to see like the Boston Lyric Opera. and some other things. But I mean, you know, it would be like once every 6 months or something. But yeah, no, in Zurich, I remember this one piece, I think it was The City of the Blind, based off, I believe it's based off the book by Jose Saramago. But the set was kind of this almost like composition of different squares and rectangles, sort of resembling vaguely architecture. But what was really interesting was they had projected a similar shapes and forms on top of it. And at certain sort of discombobulating moments, the projection would move a little bit, but it was very subtle. And so as the audience member, you kind of didn't quite understand that it was like just a projection that was being sort of like moved a little bit. And you thought that your own perception was being kind of switched. There's also a really interesting, I love a good turntable, like when the stage rotates, just a personal preference of mine. But there was a production at the Met in New York that was, I believe, a production from originally from Salzburg, in the Festspiele. I believe it was called The Exterminating Angel. And I remember this, you know, usually stages rotate, you know, for like the end of a scene or something, or the end of an act, to bring you to another part of the set or a different space. But this piece also had a very, very slow motion where the stage was rotating, but basically in an imperceptible way. I mean, you couldn't really, it was very hard to notice until after, you know, 10 or 20 minutes, you'd suddenly think, wow, the whole set is slightly shifted. How did that happen? So that was also something that was quite interesting. Yeah, and I mean, the Met's been getting some interesting pieces from Salzburg too. I think there's another sort of Austrian-American collaboration, you could say, maybe, where the pieces will travel or sort of, yeah, shared back and forth.
It's I love to hear your passion for stage design. It's so clear within your voice as you're explaining it. So between architecture and history and theater, there's a lot, and drawings as well, there's a lot of connections that it seems pretty clear that it would culminate in stage design. What were the final steps to making you want that to be your pursuit, your passion?
I mean, probably, yeah, like the final step, or the final sort of glue that brought everything, that sort of stuck everything together, was for me, for opera specifically, the music. You know, I mean, I grew up in a household where my dad was often playing classical music. And of course, as like a teenager, I'd always pretend to hate it and somehow found my way back into it as soon as I left my teenage years. So yeah, I mean, for me, I think, you know, obviously the music is the most important point. There's always arguments over, you know, music, text, and I would bring visual as a thing. But I mean, I think what's exciting is opera is really a multimedia art form. But certainly the music is pretty important. You know, it's something that I feel like I have an appreciation for. You know, like, I mean, like a lot of kids, you know, I played violin when I was much younger for a number of years. But it's been, I don't know, 15 years since I even touched a violin. So I kind of have, yeah, I had appreciation for it, but it's not something that I can create. So I think that's also what's exciting about opera and stage design, is that I'm part of something without being, you know, that I can't do all myself. So I have to rely and trust other people. So you have to kind of surround yourself with people of different talents and abilities. But yeah, and I think to get back around in terms of how it all came together, I mean, definitely the music. And also it just really felt like this crossroads of all the different things I'd studied. I mean, for stage design, you know, I like to do things that are, you know, maybe things that people haven't seen before, certainly. But there's also an aspect where you have to have an understanding of different design periods and eras and different types of things. And that was all part of my sort of art historical training, being able to look at something and say, okay, if this piece is set in, you know, 1920, that chair is obviously from the 1960s, or, you know, or whatever, or 1780, you know, that's from 1800. Not that you have to put a piece on in the time that it was created, or that it was meant to be, you know, intended to be put on, certainly not. But I think just having that sort of base idea of what you're, the parts that you're playing with is important. So stage design really felt like bringing together the kind of architectural side, the art historical side, and the music that I really love.
it's really interesting how it overlaps so far back in history as well, like the process itself and how the stage design is actually undertaken may have changed a bit, but the theory behind it seems pretty consistent. And we initially met at the Habsburg Encounters with Native America conference, quite a unique conference, I thought.
Absolutely, yeah.
And you gave a presentation called Plumes of Power, the Native American in Habsburg Festival Culture Before 1700. Mm-hmm. And throughout, you also talk about how, based off of limited understanding of Native Americans, these stage designers and artists made their own interpretations and tried to express what they looked like, sometimes as true as possible and sometimes in a much more exaggerated fashion. Can you kind of talk about how that presentation, that research came about for you and how it plays into your creative stage design background as well?
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, I mean, during my master's degree, I had a grant at the Beinecke Library, I mentioned already, and I was looking at other characters in European performances. I mean, as I started to get from art history and architectural history also into sort of theater and stage design history, I realized, you know, especially in theater with singers and actors, I mean, you're representing people that you're not. So you're often trying to sort of conjure up worlds that maybe you're less familiar with or that take place in other places. And obviously that history goes back to the very beginning of opera. And so definitely, I mean, I started to see these representations of non-Europeans in European opera of the 17th, 18th century. And it started to fascinate me how this contact or understanding, how it started and what was informing it. You know, it's so difficult to imagine, like if someone told you to, you know, to draw a picture of what, China looked like or something, and you'd never been, and there was no internet, and you had never heard of, you know, even really heard of it before, you would start to research like stage designers do today. But obviously there's a big part of the imagination. So I started to think about, and from my own perspective as a stage designer, I was sort of fascinated with, you know, thinking about a couple hundred years ago, what these people were looking at and thinking about. And there are certain groups of people that are represented in European opera, you know, before 1800, such as like the Ottomans from, you know, I mean, the Ottoman Empire. They pop up a lot, but they had close relationships with the Habsburgs in terms of, you know, shared borders, and there's always sort of conflicts going on. There's embassies sent between the two courts, and, you know, there's lots of interaction. But especially with Native Americans, I was really fascinated with what that contact was and what that thinking was. You know, there are lots of Kunstkammer that had feathered objects, you know, other things sort of plundered from the Americas, especially gold items. But even early on, sometimes gold items from the Americas were just simply, once they were brought to Europe, melted down. So a lot was lost in terms of material culture. So I started to gather and think about these sources that theater artists might be looking at and working with. Obviously printed books, like costume books, tracing like how, if there was a journal entry, I mean, or even some of like notebooks and things, and what like travel reports, like there are even versions of, I think, Christopher Columbus's travel reports that were then printed without images, and then later images were added, so obviously they're not based on much, and then of course reprinted hundreds and hundreds of times different places. So it was kind of this you can trace a little bit like the spread of ideas, which are not necessarily based on much accuracy. So I was really trying to get into the heads of some of these theater designers, because also, as I said before, for the theater, they're not necessarily trying to make something that's ethnographically correct, but there's like the sort of the what patrons wanted. So even if there was a quote unquote accurate depiction, which is really not, doesn't happen much, then there still be maybe like a patron who's supporting some sort of operatic performance, who wants to see an image of like a Native American in something extravagant or in something, you know, completely imagined and fantastical. I hope that kind of answers.
Yeah, that does well. How, so for the inaccuracies and how sometimes the intent wasn't necessarily to be as ethnographically correct, as you say, but more so a sufficient representation, I guess, would be a way to sum it up.
But I mean, there were certain tropes that started to become repeated. Like, I mean, for Native Americans, feathers. But I mean, even very early depictions, there are like feathers for, you know, images that are supposed to be Moors or sometimes even Ottomans or Asian figures. But definitely there are certain tropes like feathers, you know, relative nakedness compared to European figures. So it's, yeah, there's definitely.
So I guess what was the perception of the Habsburg people in general about Native Americans at this point? I mean, it was such a limited understanding, but what did people think?
Yeah, I mean, there were definitely, I think, so first of all, it was definitely only the kind of the upper classes that had the privilege to have access to books and publications and things and see productions, whether theater or operatic productions. You know, I mean, that's something that I don't know how you would quite study, but even thinking about like the sort of the average citizen, they probably had maybe even heard the word America or something without even really thinking about it much. But yeah, I mean, the perceptions, there's definitely, as I said, these kind of visual tropes. They would definitely think of the Native American as someone who was lesser, who was definitely othered. And that's because of, you know, especially Christian views. And a lot of Europeans, that, you know, different to what we think today, I mean, they really believed that sort of geographically where you were and the kinds of things that you wore could affect your inner temperament. So, you know, it's like when we think of putting on a costume and disguising ourselves as someone else, you know, for Halloween, we don't really think about becoming that person so much or having that affect our inner self, inner being. But there were dialogues and debates going on at the time about, you know, how much the kind of clothing you wore and how you adorned your body could affect your mind. So a lot of like Austrians, you know, Habsburg, people within the Habsburg Empire might have looked to Native Americans, especially with a kind of, you know, in the back of their heads with this maybe Catholic mentality, and seeing bodily adornment and nakedness and thinking of it as sinful. But there are also some interesting sort of parallels as well. There are some discussions and debates where people, Europeans were talking about how unlike other groups of people, such as like the Ottomans, the Ottoman Turks who were Muslim, there was obviously Islam and Christianity, there was like a, you know, a direct quarrel. Whereas they kind of saw a lot of the Native Americans as existing almost in like a, in sort of, you know, like the Garden of Eden or something in this kind of idyllic world. And that they, there were some debates about whether they were just, you know, Europeans in a kind of pre-civilized, I hate to use that, but state. So there are definitely perceptions, but I think overall in general, there's a kind of, you know, definitely partly an arrogance or, you know, thinking that they were, the Europeans themselves were better because of these qualities or at least more developed. But there is this kind of interesting linkage if you think of the Native, thinking about how they thought of the Native Americans as partially almost like existing like the Europeans in an earlier state of innocence almost. And then in terms of, well, I'll let you ask another question or so.
No, if there's something, go ahead if there's something you wanted to get
I'm trying to think, I mean, in terms of like, you know, when we see more developed opera and also festival culture. So, I mean, one thing that I'm also interested in is festival culture and performance, you know, sometimes outside of the opera house or the theater. So like in the streets and stuff, there are many, many Renaissance and Baroque festivals across Europe in different courts and ways of celebrating like masquerades as well. Ludovico Ottavio Bornacini, who I focused on in the lecture, designed these, some of the most unique Native American costumes that I've ever seen, In terms of just, you know, just, I mean, there are these visual tropes like the feathers and things, but they kind of, and you can kind of piece together influences like where he might have looked, but not copied exactly. But they're certainly, you know, just very, very bizarre, very strange. And that's why I was so fascinated with them for the Habsburg encounters with Native America, because Bornacini was Italian, but worked at the Habsburg court for across, I believe, roughly three emperors and over 50 years or about 50 years. So he was really, really indebted to the, really sort of embedded within the court. And wasn't, you know, was not just commissioned for one piece or so. So I think he definitely sort of knew what was going on at court, had that kind of mentality, knew what to do to impress the emperor and the other nobles at court. And he designed these costumes of Native Americans for these so-called Wirtschaften, which were kind of like basically parties, you know, masquerade parties in a way for usually within the Hofburg, so kind of behind closed doors. But what's also really interesting is it's one of the first times as well that the Native American is kind of on the same level as other figures in terms of like the Ottomans, or even there's a group of costumes that were sort of the old Romans, like ancient Romans, or even old old Germans. So it's so kind of almost like historical German costumes or so. So it was kind of, it's interesting to see the Native American created through these costumes that was part of a series of different peoples that was then put on at this kind of masquerade party, basically. And those costumes are what I really tried to trace throughout the article to try to find what he was looking at in terms of, you know, in terms of costume books and things like, you know, travel accounts. And it's possible he had, or highly possible, I think it's definitely, he had access to the court library, Ludovico Bornacini. So he definitely was able to look at some of these things that I'm mentioning, like costume books and such. But it's definitely what was happening at the Habsburg court in terms of these costumes was different than what we see elsewhere. Like even in Florence a little bit earlier, there are images of Native Americans used in a similar, well, an outdoor festival. And they basically look like ancient Roman heroes, except like the sort of, you know, that kind of military like kilt they wore and like breastplate and headpiece are basically feathers. So in that sense, it's like there's a little bit less imagination because it's already a kind of visual, you know, stereotype of, you know, what a kind of ancient Roman looked like. And then they just cover it in feathers. Whereas Bornacini's work for the Hofburg court is definitely something different.
Were there any major distinctions made that you observed between the Habsburg understanding of Native America and like elsewhere in Europe?
Yeah, I mean, there are definitely some interesting differences between the Habsburgs in Austria and the, you know, the Austrian realms, and then the Spanish Habsburgs before 1700. Because on the Spanish side, there's a lot of, especially in festival culture, there are a lot of representations of gold and silver, more kind of south, like indigenous peoples of South America, like kind of attempted representations of them. Whereas even with Bornacini's work for Vienna, there's kind of a mixture of peoples from North and South America in terms of like visual motifs and things that he's drawing from. But yeah, definitely, I mean, in other parts of Europe as well, like in Britain even, I mean, there's Inigo Jones at the Stuart court. And there are some instances of him copying directly out of costume books that Bornacini might have seen but didn't copy out of directly. So definitely there's, in Vienna, there's a kind of a mixture of different influences going on compared to, for example, like the Spanish Habsburgs. I mean, even in Italy as well, like in the Medici, or the Medicis, I think it was in Palazzo Pitti, there was a great Kunstkammer that had supposedly, it's documented, there were lots and lots of feathered headpieces and things from the New World that were, you know, kind of bought and traded. That could have influenced designs and things there, but definitely a little bit different than Vienna.
I'm curious what you think. I mean, the great tragedy of Native American history is how little has been told through the voices of the Native Americans themselves. But having lived on the East Coast of the United States and now in Europe, and studying how these perceptions have changed from the very first interactions to today. I'm curious how you perceive the differences in how Americans today perceive Native America and Native American history, and how Europeans perceive it, even so far as like modern culture. Like, there's debates constantly going on about sports organizations and such changing their names. But in Europe, that doesn't seem to be as much of the case, if maybe just because of a removal from just by distance. Like, there's a huge soccer team in Genk in Belgium, and their logo is still, I think, Buffalo Bill wearing a headdress. What are the perceptions, and how have you noticed differences in perceptions today? How much of these early interpretations of Native Americans in Europe persist until today, and so on?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, they're definitely still pretty persistent. I mean, the sort of stereotypes. I mean, I've definitely seen, like what you mentioned about the sports teams in Europe, definitely still things like that going on. I mean, I think definitely, I mean, in the academic world, there's more, you know, research is more conscious about what's going on. But I think in terms of what students are learning is, you know, younger students and stuff, and like in primary school or grammar school or high school, definitely more, I think, linked into some of these stereotypes. I mean, whenever I, you know, a lot of the books that I use for research are from, you know, either American scholars or Europeans who are at American universities and writing. I mean, not to say that there's nothing coming out of Europe, but I think the discussion and the sort of way things are changing is definitely happening in America. In terms of that understanding, there's a lot of artifacts still in Europe, though. I mean, even the Quetzal headdress in Vienna that was in Schloss Ambras for a while, I believe, I mean, this was maybe, I don't remember it, I just saw like reports about it, but maybe 15, 20 years ago or something, there were protests to try to return it to Mexico. And I think some of the arguments on the European side was that it had been in Europe for 500 years or something. But I mean, there's definitely a lot of objects here in, you know, from originally from Kunstkammer that are now in major museum collections, European museum collections, that I think definitely need more study and are being recognized by American scholars and audiences. But I think sort of uncovering more and tracing the history of objects is something that is quite interesting and needs to happen a bit more. But yeah, in terms of these stereotypes, I mean, even similar to your story about the image of Buffalo Bill and the headdress, I mean, you know, just even walking around Vienna, sometimes there might be a poster for some kind of some kind of event somewhere, and it's, you know, like the Wild West, and you still see it's a modern poster, and there's just like a sort of very stereotypically looking headdress. So there's a lot of work that still needs to be done, for sure.
Great. Well, is there anything else that you wanted to touch on that we maybe haven't touched on, or that you feel people should take away from this?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I need to think of it. I mean, I think to bring some of the different, you know, different pieces together, I mean, I think in terms of understanding different peoples and processing, especially trauma and traumatic experiences within different communities, you know, theater, music, opera, I think is one of a great way to do that, whether it's sort of, as I mentioned before, you know, really turning traditional pieces on their head and questioning the sort of inherent racism in some of the pieces, or putting on new pieces, you know, composers with different voices. I think that's definitely something that the US is doing pretretty well. Like I mentioned before, the Met Opera putting on some really interesting new operas in the last couple of seasons. But I think definitely in Vienna, there's still a lot of more, you know, these traditional pieces are kind of the big sellers. So, but yeah, I think there's a lot of room for healing and discussion within musical works and pedagogy and sort of studying them. I think one thing that's really great in Vienna is when I was during my combined grant, one of my teaching classes, there was a group of, I think the students were all 16 or 17. This was in a hotel in Vienna. And one of the lessons I planned was sort of about music and opera and stuff. And I was so sort of almost shocked, I mean, pretty amazed that pretty much every single student had at least been to the opera once, had seen an opera or a concert performance or something, but we were specifically talking about opera. And I think just having that chance, that exposure, was really great, especially in developing attitudes and ideas about what these operas represent. You know, if we don't go see them, that discussion doesn't happen. And so many of these operas deal with traumatic themes and have this sort of inherent racism and stereotypes. So I think looking back on them, challenging them, continuing to put on new pieces is a great thing to do. And seeing how many young people go to the opera in Austria, even if they're dragged by their grandparents, they still have been. And I think that's a really encouraging thing.
I think that's a great way to end it. Find the closest opera to you and go.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you for being on, Alex.
Yeah, thank you so much, Luke.
Thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoyed the episode. Remember to check the episode description to find more from our guest. Follow us on social media or turn on notifications to get alerts for future episodes. The Buchdieber Institute for Austrian American Studies promotes an understanding of the historic relationship between the United States and Austria, including the lands of the former Habsburg Empire, by awarding grants and fellowships, organizing lectures and conferences, and publishing the Journal of Austrian American History. We engage with a broader public audience through digital programming, including videos, podcasts, and blog posts. Auf Wiedersehen, and see you next time.